Hey y'all, I'm Kat.
Hey Kat.
I'm an alcoholic.
Hey
Kat. All right, let's have an AA meeting. Welcome to the Monday Night Blues Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describe in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope that no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear a speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them, too, I must have this thing. And it is my pleasure I get to introduce the speaker tonight. I always enjoy what he has to share at the Friday night meetings and even Tuesday night meetings. And he's always very willing to help when it comes to service work. So, well, maybe not willing so much, but he does it. So, anyway, I will introduce you tonight to our speaker, Scott.
This is being recorded, right?
Yeah. Hi, I'm and I'm an alcoholic. I'm Scott and I'm an alcoholic. So it's an honor to be asked to come up and share my experience, strength, and hope. Keep in mind I've been admitting to nothing. And but with that, I'll do my best. So, really, I'm really quite nervous tonight. There were a lot fewer people here like 10 minutes ago. So, usually start off with a little joke, and that way it falls flat. Boom, boom, breaks the ice, and there's only the only where to go from there is up. So, I had some words that were difficult to say when alcoholics are drinking, and those are preliminary emotive aluminum. And then there are things that are very difficult to say, which is specificity, loquaciousness, transubstantiate. And these are things that are impossible to say. No thanks, I've had enough. Sorry, you're not my type. You're right, I cannot jump over that table. So, the table got somebody there. No one ever better than I thought. So, 13 years ago, I woke up sort of, let's just say, covered in my own bodily functions in a strange hallway. And I'm not sure if I, you know, woke up, came to. It's a fine line, right? And I looked around, and I had those few seconds before I realized who I was and what my life was, and that I was okay, and that it all came rolling back to me. And I knew at that point my prayers were not answered because I was alive for another day, and I really didn't want to be. I think for about 2 years there, I would end or start every day in an attempt to drink myself to death, to end the misery that I was trapped in. You know, it may have started off as a party, but that was like 20 years ago, and everybody but me had gone home. I looked around, I kind of realized I was in a friend's house. I'm not sure if he knew I was there. At the time, I drove a Jeep. You know, living out of your car is not as easy as people make it sound. You have to find a place to park where people are going to leave you alone. You still need to find various ways. So I sort of was parked in my friend's grandparents' house driveway. They had passed away, and he had let me stay there before. So I realized that when I got up there, I had a lot of cleaning to do. But I also had a habit I needed to support. I was already shaking. Usually it couldn't go more than a couple hours before I had to start drinking again because the shakes just wouldn't leave me alone. So I got in my Jeep, and the keys were already in it, because I was never, it took too long. I just never took the keys out because it took too long to get them in the ignition. Funny though, I never really thought twice about driving, but I couldn't get the keys into the car. I got to a little gas station and I picked out, some beer and boxes of wine stuff that I could handle. And I get up there and he tells me, we don't sell liquor on Sunday. I'm like, it's Saturday. The last thing I remember was Friday night. And then I realized, oh, I messed up. I blacked out through the entire Saturday. And now I have no way to get cheap booze. And I got a big problem. So I had a few bucks. I went to a restaurant and ordered a couple shots of something. I could barely keep it down. I usually drank some wine in the morning, and then I'd follow it with the liquor because liquor on an empty stomach had a tendency to come right back up. But I was already in really, really rough shape. So that year, that was October, I'd already been hospitalized 10 times that year for alcohol poisoning, dehydration, low potassium levels, I think it's hypokalemia, and rhabdomyolysis, which is a really good one if you've ever had it, where your skeletal muscles start to break down. You sort of have uncontrollable movements. So I had I drank what I could afford, and then I went back to the house to look for some more. I've already killed the old liquor cabinet. My friend's grandparents used to live there. He was a bootlegger. He had all these big jars of wine from the 1940s of crystallized gel at the bottom. I was trying to get to that. It was kind of really horrible. Then I noticed there was a lot of stuff in the hallway I still needed to clean up. So I was kind of doing that, and I noticed, I was just sort of crying, and I came through the couches. I looked everywhere. I found a couple bucks, and I went to this little dive bar pool hall. It's in Sandy Springs, sort of in the back of Rosarito. It's next to a movie theater. It's a real horrible place if anybody's ever been there. And I thought maybe if he sees how bad he needs a drink, he would, pour me a good one. I could afford one shot. I downed the thing, and it came straight back up, and I was looking for a glass, and I caught it and put it right back down because I couldn't afford to lose it. At that point, I was shaking so much, I didn't know what to do. I looked at the clock. It was about 4. It was 4 p.m. I just needed to make it to midnight, and I could go to that first Shell on Roswell Road and Lake Forest or Powers Ferry. It's the first place inside the Atlantis city limits that starts selling liquor at 12:01 a.m. Monday morning. And the clock was moving slow. It was moving real slow. I saw a gas can. I tried to drink a little bit of that. I've had about 2 fingers of maybe 30-year-old peach schnapps. I'm not even sure which one was more gross. But really, I know what happens to alcoholics is they abruptly stop drinking. The thing is, at that point, I was probably drinking, about 2 half-gallons of liquor every day. I needed a 5th just to get out of bed in the morning and stop shaking, and I hadn't had near that much that day already. So I usually tried to arrange it so I'd have something for the next morning, but and this may come as a shock to you. Every morning, it was all gone. So no matter what I tried to do and what I tried, and then I sort of had some memories while I was cleaning the carpet or spreading the mess around, depending upon how you look at it. I sort of had a memory the night before where I was trying to light a cigarette, and these really old matches where the heads were flying off the little striker paper every time I tried to light it, but I didn't actually have a cigarette in my mouth because I'd run out of those too. And I kind of set myself on fire, which explained, I looked over, there was a little burnt blanket on the couch, my hands were really in pain, and I'd lost a big chunk of my hair too. And And then I remember there was a little, I was trying to light a cigarette that wasn't there, and I'm like, isn't this kind of, why are we doing this? And I remember seeing a little bit of a tumbler full of liquid on there, and I wasn't going to use that to put out the fire because it might have been liquor. It turned out to be water. So I put the fire out with my hands instead. And well, that explained why my hands were hurting so bad, because at first I didn't even know that. That was made a little earlier in the morning. So I remember a few days back, of course, it was the middle of the night, and I swore off drinking, probably for the millionth time. I swore I was going to stop drinking. I was crying. I'm a dude, but man, I cried a lot, I'll tell you. I'm sitting there drinking alcohol out of one bottle, and I'm pouring another bottle down the sink. And I thought about it. I wanted to quit drinking so bad. I was pouring the booze down the sink, but at the same time, I'm chugging it because I know without it, I don't know what I'm going to do. I need it to live, but, you know, every day I've just been blacking out and coming to and blacking out and coming to, and I was thinking about that, and I must have, like, passed out because all of a sudden it was, like, 10 p.m., and I'm like, well, you know, we don't want to get there too late. So I get in my car again, and I start driving down Roswell Road. And here's what I can tell you. I'm not sure why. But, you know, just as you cross inside of 285, the Prado Shopping Center is down Roswell Road, and there's a big blue H, you know, pointing to the left. And I'm driving down the road, and I'm just determined to get to that gas station, and I'll just sit there until 12, or maybe he'll sell it to me early, or I don't really have enough money to bribe him, but, you know, I'll do something, I'll figure out something. Maybe I could steal a beer to get me till 12. I saw the blue H, and something in my, I still, to this day, I can't explain it. I said, you know what, maybe we'll go to the hospital instead. And I took a left, about 6 feet before the actual intersection. It's a good thing I was in a Jeep. And I drove to Northside Hospital. If any of you have been to Northside Hospital, the ER, it's not the most straightforward thing to get to. So, again, I just drove right through the bushes and up two of the terraced parts where there aren't any road. And I stopped about this far from the glass doors. And I go running, I don't know, I'm just really excited about my decision, and I go running to the desk, and I'm like, you gotta help me, I'm gonna die. And, you know, it's like, yeah, sure you are, sir, everybody's gonna die, please have a seat. But she looks up, she took one look at me and goes, come back here. So, if you're ever in the hospital, you know something's up. So I guess the first thing, they got an IV in me, and all of a sudden, I felt so much better. I felt so much better. You know what I felt like? I felt good enough. I felt like a drink. That's how better I felt. I felt like I could go get a drink. A little bit hazy. I had several doctors come to me, and like I said, I've been to the hospital 10 times that year, and they're always saying, if you keep doing what you're doing, you're going to die. And, you know, 6 months previous, they said, you know, you've got about 8 months if you don't change what you're doing. And I'm like, what am I doing? You know, playing like they don't know, right? You know, 2 months later, I go to the hospital, they say, you got about 6 months. And then go back, and they're like, you got about 4 months. And my only thought was, man, these guys are good. They really know what they're talking about. And the thing that I wasn't really willing to face is that I wanted to die, but I didn't have the guts or courage or wherewithal just to make it stop then and there. So every day or every night or every whenever, as I'm chugging down that second half gallon of really cheap vodka, yeah, the good stuff decades behind me, sorry, there was some good stuff in the story, but that's not really what we're talking about, is it? I prayed to God that I never woke up, and that's how I knew there was no God, because every morning my prayers had gone unanswered. If there was a God, I've never woken up. So I'm in the hospital. I'm feeling a lot better now. And the director of Northside Mental Health, he comes talking to me, and I'm still like, well, yeah, you know, maybe I drink some here or there. But I'm pretty sure I'm crazy. If you find a way to fix the crazy, I won't have to drink. Turns out I was right, but not in the way I thought I was right. But you know, I don't want to get ahead of that story, right? I was really convinced for some reason I would admit to anything except for being an alcoholic. And I don't know why, but I think I realized that alcoholism, if you're not in these rooms, is a really lonely diagnosis. It's about the loneliest thing you can think of. So you know that lady when you're in the hospital that comes in and asks for your proof of insurance? I'm like, oh, that's funny. Yeah, right. I don't have any of that. And she makes it, you know, she fills it out on her list. Well, I'm no stranger to Northside. I knew half the orderlies there by first name at that point in the ER. And so they decide, you know, I already owe them about $60,000 or $70,000. And so they're not going to let me stay. They're going to kick me out. But the director of Northside Mental Health, he seemed to care more about me than I did. And I hear him on the phone outside the room, and he's yelling and screaming. He's going, if you don't admit this guy, if you don't admit this kid, it's funny, I'm a kid. He's like, if you don't admit this kid, he's going to die. And for the first time in my life, I heard what he said. And I realized that I didn't want to die. So, I had bigger problems, though, because I came to the hospital without cigarettes. So, you know, this was back when you could still, they had the nice little smoking atrium in Northside. So about every hour I'd go down to smoke, but you know, it's not that simple. I got to get the pole. I got to unhook all these things. I got like 8 things on my pole. You get in the elevator, there are other people, and you're like, oh, look, he only has 4 things on his pole. He's going to be okay. And that guy like has 10 things. Whoa, dude, you're in bad shape. But I took my little pole and my 8 little things on the pole, wheeled it down. Usually they're nurses, you know, somebody's out there smoking. Somebody ought to get a memo to the nurses, by the way. You know, that shit isn't good for you. There's always somewhere to bum a cigarette. But at this time, there wasn't anybody. So I'm like, I'm combing through the ashtrays looking for butts. You know, never giving a thought to, right, I'm actually digging through ashtray looking for cigarette butts, but I still think I got it all under control, right? I mean, how funny is that? And this guy comes out, and I remember him to this day because he kind of reminded me of that comedian Jeff Foxworthy, who's not as famous as he used to be, but he had these ice blue eyes, and he was skinny to the point of being emaciated. And he had about the same number of things on his pole, so I knew he wasn't doing very well. And he reaches out a hand, and I look down. And there's a cigarette in his hand. And, you know, my first thought was, oh, man, it's one of those generic fucked up things, right? I'm, like, digging through an ashtray looking for butts, but I'm too good for generic cigarettes. But I managed to swallow my pride, accepted the cigarette, and sat down on a bench. And then all the nurses come out and start smoking. And I'm like, and, you know, they've got the good stuff. Like, you know, I don't want to product place any cigarettes, but, you know, they're smoking better cigarettes. But I already had one. I figure, oh, I'll get one for next time. But I kept noticing it was really hard to smoke because I couldn't stop crying. And the guy looks over to me and he goes, like, why are you crying? And I'm like, because I'm going to die. And he goes, well, have you asked God for help? And part of my brain looked at him and said, doesn't look like God's fucking helping you much, is he? But you know what? That ungrateful, snide, sarcastic part of my brain had just spent the last 25 years getting its ass kicked. And what came out instead was, I don't know how. So he said a little prayer, and I'll spare you. It was really simple, and It was something I never heard, and I think I got to remember what it was. But, and I think for the first time in my life, without realizing it, I asked God for help instead of telling Him how to help me. So some of you may recognize like a first step when you see it, but at the time, you know, I didn't know. And he looked at me. And he holds my hand. And he looked at me. Those just like his eyes were just like the ice blue rocks. And he says, "You're going to be okay." I didn't feel okay, I'll tell you that. I don't want to ruin the story, but every single day of my life since, I've been okay. Again, I didn't know that at the time. So my sister came by the hospital. Bless her heart. She bought me a carton of cigarettes. I go back out in an hour. The guy's not there. Never saw him again. I asked the nurses about that guy, you know, with all the, or described him. And they're like, "I never saw him. Like, nobody ever remembers seeing him." I'm like, "You were right there smoking with your friend, the guy who was right there. You know, what's his, what room's he in? What name's he in?" I was sort of got sidetracked on a mission to find this guy. And I start coming through the ashtrays to look for Bronson cigarette butts to prove that, you know, he wasn't a figment of my imagination. But I never saw that guy again. But go figure, you know, when, don't say God didn't have a sense of humor, I need an angel and he sends me a redneck. So. And then the other angel, my sister, she starts talking to the doctor, and I guess she doesn't like the prognosis because she is just bawling, and it hurts a lot more to see her cry than me. I'm pretty close to my baby sister. And by that point, she's the only person in my family that, you know, would even talk to me. I lied, cheated, and stole. You know, I'm pretty much persona non grata across the board. And I've never had such a big family, so there weren't too many people to go through. And then a doctor came and gave me the bad news. He's like, "I tried to get you admitted." And I'm like, "Yeah, I heard." but they're just, they won't let me admit you. And I look at him, I go, what am I going to do? I was still pretty sure, you know, this thing is, I'm going to be in the back of the room by the time I'm done, man. So, and he says, "Well, have you been to a place called 8111? Which I had never heard. I've driven by that place 10,000 times in my life. I grew up here. Never even noticed the damn sign, which I think is kind of the point. But he told me where it was, and me, I know a liquor store right down the street from there. Triangle would have been easier, right? Or or I like Freedom Club because they have the upstairs liquor store. It's really convenient. But so I got out, and I missed this part, but, you know, when I ran in there, when they first gave me the IV, I said, "Oh, you know what? My Jeep's sort of outside in the bushes. Could somebody take care of that for me? Give them their keys." And they did. They brought it out and they parked it. They gave me the keys and I was on my own again. So I drive down to this little liquor store at Northside and Roswell Road. You might know the place. The guy certainly knew me. You know that when you first you have your Monday liquor store, your Tuesday, your Thursday, and you're going, "Yep, having another big party tonight here." Coom, coom, coom. I'd given up on that. I just went to the nearest, closest place, you know. I never said anything. I could barely get the money out of my wallet. Sometimes I'd just hand him the wallet and he'd take what he thought I owed him and push the rest back to me and leave my car running again because it was just too hard to get the keys. And I was at that liquor store, and, you know, hospital, they don't really, you know, they release you when you release you. They don't really think about your convenience. So it was like 4:30 in the morning, and I'm out, and I'm standing in front of the liquor store waiting for the, I don't even know when they open. And I'm like, "Well, you said 8111 Roswell Road." So I turn around, I drive up there. It's still pretty quiet. There's nobody there. I drive back to the liquor store. I spent the morning kind of driving back and forth. But guess where I got out of my car? I did, and I was about to jump right back in, and somebody saw me, and they go, "Uh-uh, you're in the right place. You come here." And I went, I think my first meeting was 11 a.m., 11:30, one of those. The very first thing I ever heard when I walked into my very first AA meeting was a woman telling her sponsee that she needs to pick up a chip at every meeting that she goes to for a week. I didn't know it was a blue chip, but she seemed pretty serious about it. So that week I picked up 47 white chips, sometimes not even moving out of my chair. And I could see people going, he's just not getting it, is he? I'm looking under, where is he drinking? But you know, I stayed for meeting. I just went to meeting after meeting after meeting. And at one of them I raised my hand and said that I was an alcoholic. And it was the most liberating thing that ever happened to me. And I don't know why. I still didn't think my prognosis was that good. Somebody came up after the meeting and they go, well, how are you feeling? I'm like, I feel like I'm going to have a drink when I leave here. Well, he goes, don't leave. That was my first suggestion ever, and I took it. I stayed in that freaking clubhouse for 3 straight weeks. I slept on the bench. I went to every meeting. I even went to the women's meetings. They're like, just, you need a meeting, we can tell, but, you know, shut up, sit back, and don't say anything. And, you know, honestly, I don't know what I'd do today because they don't, they closed up pretty early, but back then they kept the doors open and the coffee running, so people loitered until 4:35 in the morning. Their first meeting's like 6:15, so I didn't have to be alone very much. But people coming in and out sort of, you know, called me the porch guy because I was always kind of living there on the porch. My second day, some guy in a cowboy hat with a smile way too big to be real comes up and he's like, where's your big book? I'm like, what's that? Oh, that blue book thing? And he's like, what makes you think you can stop drinking? And I said, I don't think I can stop drinking. Because, you know, I'm sure I wasn't really reading anything my first meeting, but at some point I looked up, I saw those steps in the wall. Like many of us, I did them all in my head immediately. I knew they didn't work. And decided, well, this isn't for me. I'll just go. And then I'm like, well, I have nowhere to go. So I'll stay here. But I was sure, you know, man, I had big problems. I needed big, serious medicine. I don't know, pills, shots, electricity, something. Like, there's nothing in the book that's going to save my ass. So this guy said, oh, by the way, I'm David. I'm your sponsor. And I'm like, oh, did I get a cool jacket with logos on it? Or, I got sponsored now. Cool. I really didn't know what a sponsor was. I was sort of listening to me. I actually stayed in the back and was pacing back and forth because I couldn't sit still in my chair. I'm still sort of vibrating a little bit. And so I kind of hang in the back of the big room and just walk back and forth. But, you know, I started to be able to sit down a little bit. And he bought me a big book and a 12 and a 24-hour a day. He told me to read them, but he knew I was kind of in no shape to read. So he sat down and he read it with me. And every morning before work, he showed up at a meeting. Every day for the 5:45, he came there to look for me. And I was there because I wasn't going anywhere. People would bring me food. Sometimes they'd take me down to the gas station. Everybody was so much nicer to me than I'd been to myself for a long, long time. You know, when you're sick, though, everybody looks healthy, right? The better you get, the sicker everybody else starts to look. But back then, every single person, the guy with 1 week sober was a picture of mental health. The guy with 30 days was a freaking miracle. So I was in the perfect shape. I could be helped by anybody who walked into an AA meeting because literally I was the sickest guy there at that point. Now, as it turns out, we have a witness here tonight. He was there. My first day, I go to this, some people took me to a meeting called the Mount Vernon group. It was really big back then. And that was on a Thursday night, so that's how I know my first day, I think, was a Wednesday. And I didn't find out this until years later, because my sponsor was a part of that group. And he's like, the first day you walked in, we had a little powwow by the coffee machine. and we wondered if we needed to call an ambulance because we couldn't have you dying in the meeting. So that's just a little fun story for you to hear. I'm like, man, I'm 2 days out of the hospital. I should be feeling pretty good, right? You know, they booted me out with a handful of anti-seizures, and, you know, I really thought about, you know, going back. But so David started showing up to the clubhouse, and miraculous things started to happen, which was, you know, I stopped feeling like I needed to drink. I mean, it didn't happen like that. I'll tell you, there were still a few days that was rough. But he started reading the book to me, and we started talking about it. And he asked me if I believe in God, and I said, I said, no, I don't think so. I prayed for a lot of stuff. I never got it. And he just asked, well, do you believe I believe in God? And I'm like, you're smiling too much not to believe in God, dude. I'll tell you that. And he said, do you believe I'm 10 years sober? Do you believe I was able to stay sober for 10 years? As much as I could wrap my head around 10 years, I'm like, yeah. And he's like, well, I'm going to believe in God for you until you believe in Him for yourself. But you're going to pray every day anyway. And, you know, I had no smart ass left. I'm like, he did it. He said it, and I did it. But, you know, I went to a lot of meetings, which means I met a lot of people, and I didn't always rub them all the right way, so to speak. But, you know, they're a pretty regular crew, and they're people that got to see me slowly get sober, including a woman whose car I hit about a week before I came into AA, who gently, in a very frightening way, reminded me that I owed her money for her deductible. I kept running into cars when I would drive to Kroger, and I came to the conclusion that the parking lot was cursed because it couldn't have anything to do with what I was drinking, so I started parking across the street and walking there. So she actually happened to work at Northside Mental Health for, what do you know? But I worked the steps and I prayed, and in about 2 weeks I woke up. And I didn't, the first thought in my head wasn't that I needed or wanted a drink. It was a bloody miracle, I'll tell you. From then on, I'm like, you know, maybe there's something to this God thing. I had a lot of moments where I felt touched, you know, where I felt the presence of something that was far too positive to have been mine. It had to come from outside. He told me how to do a 4-step, and I did it. And I think in about 90 days, you know, we had finished the first 164 pages of the book. And he's like, okay, now, when they ask in a meeting, if you're willing to help take someone through the steps, I want you to raise your hand. I'm like, are you kidding me? He's like, you know, I've given you something, and now you have to give it away. I wasn't the only person that felt that. When my hand started going up, there were some serious, dubious looks in the room. I think they were thinking something along the lines of, are you fucking kidding me? God was smart enough not to deliver a sponsee to me until much, much later. But he's like, The sobriety that you have, what's been given to you, you won't keep it unless you give it away. You know, we've gone through the book, but a lot of that's still hazy. I've been through the book a lot more since then. But I raised my hand because in 90 days I knew something, that I hadn't had a drink of freaking alcohol for 90 days. And the only thing that is in connection with that is that I did everything this man told me to do. So he told me to do something, I did it. And let's see, probably around the same time, I met somebody, and a month later found out she was pregnant. And my sanity wasn't the only thing that had returned, apparently. I was told that I was never going to be able to have children. Well, they were wrong. So, wow, that didn't get a single laugh. Ouch. But I sort of had one of those moments that I wanted to run away and hide again. I wanted to go drink, but I just decided, you know what, if I'm going to be a father, I'm going to be the best one that I can possibly be. And I never was the kind of guy I thought was going to be a father, much less a good one. I think I had a pretty good example of what not to do for my own father. It was sort of a... there were a lot of challenges with that relationship and with learning how to raise a child. But there were also some amazing blessings. I think I would have called him the God of my misunderstanding, the God of my non-understanding. I really didn't get what unconditional love was until, I held my baby the first time. It gave me the idea of what God must feel when he looked at me, when he looked at us. And I'm like, wow, I'm a shitty parent, and look how much I love this kid. Imagine what a perfect parent would do. I think there were some sort of, you can only do so much. I was still pretty self-centered, and it might have ended up going out and drinking again, but for the constant reminder that I had to be there for somebody else. And to this day, I think, I'm not sure I would have stayed sober. If I didn't have a kid, on the other hand, if I kept doing what my sponsor said, I probably would stay sober. But it's not really a question that's going to have an answer, right? Because I do have a kid, and I need to stay sober. So a couple, like a month ago, I kind of broke my leg. I was taking a meeting to a halfway house and something, I tore my calf muscle on the way there. I was really hoping something like that was going to happen tonight on my way here. And it didn't. So somebody gave me some advice early before the meeting and said stop at hope. So here's the thing. I have a gift, and my gift is to be able to see the downside in everything. My gift is to be able to see the flaw, to see what's wrong with everything. That's what I do for a living. I get paid to go in there and find what's fucked up. So when your superpower is pessimism, but your life depends on having a positive outlook. If you think I can't get by without God every day, then you're crazier than me. And I'm not going to say it's really, I really haven't wanted to take a drink maybe one time in 13 years, but that's not to say I hadn't wanted to kill myself or somebody else in 13 years. That's not to say I didn't have... I've had a bottom or two in sobriety, I'll tell you, and it was every bit as ugly as when I woke up in my own stuff that last day drinking. But I always remember that last day drinking. I always remember the pain and the despair. Because when I started drinking, it made me feel normal. And a doctor once said they don't call it self-medicating for nothing. And it worked. Alcohol saved my life. It was my... somebody said, I'm not an alcoholic because alcohol is my problem. I'm an alcoholic because alcohol is my solution. And it worked. It worked well until it stopped working. And that's pretty much the place where I started. Actually, I think pretty obvious stopped working several years before I started that story. But, it got worse and worse. Somebody commented to me at my first year, it's like, oh, so you did the Richard Pryor thing to get sober. And I never thought of that. And like, yeah, I set myself on fire, didn't I? It's sort of funny. I can laugh at that now. That's pretty amazing. So I've had my bottoms in sobriety. I've had my craziness. For a while, I went to another 12-step program because I felt that I needed that more. But I think my sponsor said something really wise, and he's like, did you get what you need out of there? Where do you think you can do the most good? Where do you think you could be mostly of service? And I said, I think that's an AA. So he's like, well, that's where you go back to. And so last year I sort of recommitted to doing this program with a kind of intensity and fervor. I mean, I was really like a little big book Nazi there for a while. I know it irritated the hell out of people. But I was so excited. It saved my life, and I knew it could save yours if you would just do the same stuff that I did. You know, we get a little mellower with age, and I like to think I've sawed some of those hard edges off. But I'd never forget that first day. Like I said, if you think you can live life in my body without God, then you're crazy. And this is how I found God. And I hope that message gives hope to somebody. Thank you.
Thank you for your story. Wow, you did push this up. The one thing I like about speaker meetings is you always learn a little something that you didn't know about the person, and I see him a lot on Friday nights, so thank you for your story. I really appreciate that. Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers Meeting tonight.
I got nowhere to hide.